This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Do you really understand the president's tax plan? You know it will affect your pocketbook, for better or for worse. You know it will affect how much money the government has to spend on federal programs. But can you make sense of the confusing details and cut through the political rhetoric? My guest, David K. Johnston, covers the tax system for The New York Times. He's made it his mission to investigate behind-the-scenes political and financial maneuvering and to explain it to his readers. Last month, he won a Pulitzer Prize for Beat Reporting for his coverage of tax inequities and loopholes. As Congress continues with its complex process on the budget and tax plans, we invited Johnston to talk with us about our tax system. Johnston says he's neither for nor against the Bush tax policy. What he is for is honesty in the debate. I asked him what he thinks has been the most misrepresented aspect of the tax debate.
I'm not sure that the public appreciates the degree to which this is a tax cut totally focused on people at the high end of the income stream, and how for the group known as the next 4%, that is people who on the income ladder on the 95th, 6th, 7th, 8th, and 9th rungs of the ladder are paying for this, as to some degree are those between the 80th and 95th. The tax cut as designed by the president initially provided at a minimum 45% of the benefits over the next 10 years to the top 1% of the income group. These are people who average over $1 million a year of income. If you are a person anywhere below that, you get very little. For example, if you're in the next 4% group, that's people who make $145,000 to about $350,000, that's a group heavily occupied by two-income career couples and professionals who are not in finance and investment banking, and business owners. Your average tax cut is about $1,300 on the income tax side. The people right above, the top 1%, their average tax cut is $28,000. And within that group, the very wealthiest people, the top 400 taxpayers in America, get an average tax break of about $2 million each per year, just in income taxes.
Does your research show that the supporters of President Bush's proposed tax breaks are intentionally gearing these tax breaks for the wealthy, that they know what they're doing, they want the wealthy to get the biggest cuts?
Oh, sure. And I think they've acknowledged that here and there, that their argument is that those who pay the most ought to get the most in tax relief. And we do have a system now where if you are a family of four, you don't start paying income taxes till you're at about $28,000 of income. On the other hand, let's take that group, the top 400 people in this country who have an average income of $110 million each in 1998. Those people are getting a tax break under this plan that is disproportionate to their income and their share of the taxes. They're getting more than twice as much compared to their share of the taxes. In the top 1% group, those people pay 35% of the income taxes in this country. They make about, I think it's 18% of the income, and they will pay about 35% of the taxes. They're getting about 45% of the tax breaks. So it's not proportional. It is very heavily weighted towards that group. Secondly, the fundamental flaws that put a lot of unfairness in the tax system that have traditionally been complained about by Republicans in Washington are not being addressed in this plan. The most important of these is the alternative minimum tax.
What is that?
Well, back in 1969, when I was a young man, I remember one day picking up my morning newspaper where I worked, and a story appeared that 55 wealthy Americans, people who made over $200,000, paid no income taxes. And this caused a huge political uproar, and very quickly, Congress passed a tax designed to make sure that very wealthy people have to pay something, that you can't use aggressive tax deductions to pay zero income tax. It has not been a success. In the most recent year we have data for, 1998, 2,400 people did not pay any income tax and had an income of over $200,000. Instead, though, but Congress hasn't fixed the alternative minimum tax. And what's happened now is that a single mother making $28,000 can pay the alternative minimum income tax. And under President Bush's plan, about 80% of people who make $80,000 to $200,000 will pay the alternative minimum income tax when his plan, as originally proposed, would be fully phased in. The tax, however, does not apply to the wealthy. If you make $350,000 or more, you don't pay the alternative minimum income tax because Congress has not adjusted it to keep pace with inflation and other changes in the tax law.
So what does that mean if you make under $350,000 a year and you have to pay this alternative minimum tax? How does the alternative minimum tax compare to what you'd ordinarily pay?
It's sort of like a Star Trek show, you know, where they have a parallel universe. There's a parallel universe of taxes called the alternative minimum tax. You have to figure your income taxes two times, and then you have to pay the higher figure. And under the alternative minimum tax, you lose your deductions for state and local taxes. You lose your children because these are considered tax shelters under the law. Now, I don't know anybody who has children as a tax shelter, and I say this as the father of eight.
When you say you lose your children, you lose them as deductions.
That's correct. You lose them as deductions. And therefore, this tax applies very heavily to people in the high-tax states, which happen to be, by the way, the states that produce lots of revenue for the federal government. So if you have a large family and you live in New Jersey, New York, Connecticut, Massachusetts, Maryland, California, you will be hit almost certainly by the alternative minimum tax under President Bush's plan if you make more than $80,000 a year, but less than about $350,000.
And if you live in one of these states, you won't be able to deduct, you won't be able to use your children as deductions.
You won't be able to use your children as deductions. And in addition, you will lose the deductions for the property taxes you paid on your home and the state and local income taxes you paid on your wages.
So this is only if President Bush's plan goes through?
That's under the terms of his original plan. Mm-hmm. We don't have any of the details of the revised shrunken down plan, which is about three quarters the size of the old one. We don't know yet how Congress is going to divvy up those tax cuts.
And when will we know?
When Congress decides to put out a bill for markup, hopefully in a few days, but probably at the last minute just before they vote for it, when there'll be very little time for the public to scrutinize its details before it becomes law.
Well, I mean, how many people even know about the alternative minimum tax? I mean, this is the kind of thing, doesn't it just like go right past the public's radar?
The alternative minimum tax is a stealth tax. A lot of people don't know they pay it. You would have to look on your tax return. If you prepare your taxes on a program like TurboTax, it does it for you automatically, but you may notice the line that says it. If you, like many people, you have a tax professional do your taxes and you just sign them, you just look at the total dollars that are there. But it's an enormous revenue maker for the government. Under the president's original proposal, alternative minimum tax revenues would increase by $132 billion. So basically, people who are in the $80,000 to $350,000 income range, that's the top 10% minus the very top 1%, that group of people would face an additional $132 billion tax burden over 10 years.
So is it fair to say that the people in the $80,000 to under $350,000 income bracket would be making up a lot of the difference, that the very rich won't be paying in taxes if the plan goes through?
I think that's a fair way to look at it, that this shifts to a significant degree from the top 1% to the next 9% where the government is relying for its revenue. And there's a fundamental difference between these two groups of people. The top 1% are people who own businesses, in many cases, who belong to organizations that are significant sources of campaign contributions. The next group, the next nine rungs on the ladder, are not in the same class as a whole, and they don't have the kind of clout in Washington that people do in the top 1%.
My guest is New York Times reporter David K. Johnston. He won a Pulitzer Prize last month for his reporting on tax inequities and loopholes. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is David K. Johnston, and he won a Pulitzer Prize this year for beat reporting for coverage of inequities and loopholes in the tax code. Now, you wrote a couple of articles about the estate tax that had a lot of impact. President Bush has said he wants to repeal the estate tax, and one reason why he gave for it, he said he wanted to save the family farm. You investigated whether repealing the estate tax would help save the family farm. What did you find?
Well, I went out to Iowa, and I interviewed about two dozen Republican farmers who laughed at me. One of them said to me, boy, you city boys are really dumb, aren't you? You swallow that stuff, huh? And these guys thought it was just hilarious that we would believe that. And I'd say to them, well, excuse me, this is the leader of your party. And they'd say, yeah, well, he's trying to get something else, and he's just using us. In the Midwest, Grain Belt states, 100% of the income farmers receive now comes in the form of subsidies from Washington for price supports. Nationwide, it's about 50% of farm income. And what farmers want are better prices for their crops. Under current law, you can pass about $4.1 million of farm property to your heirs without paying income taxes if they want to continue farming. If they don't want to continue farming, you can pass $2.6 million. The average net worth of farms in Iowa is $1.2 million. The existing law, without any special breaks for farmers, covers farmers. And the American Farm Bureau Federation could not supply us with a single example anywhere in America of a farm lost to estate taxes.
Did you go back and talk to the Bush administration about that?
The position of the Bush administration is that farmers have to plan for the tax. They shouldn't have to do so. They don't call it the estate tax. They call it the death tax. And they argue that it is immoral to tax someone at death.
After your article saying that there's no evidence that the estate tax has ever forced a family to lose its farm, what did the Bush administration have to say? Did they respond to the article?
Not directly. They stopped using farms as an example in their rhetoric. They continue to push for repeal of it. And in recent days in Washington, I've noticed that a number of congressmen are back to saying that we need to repeal the estate tax in order to save the family farm. That is, once you get inside the Beltway, you're in another universe, and there's often little relationship between the blather you hear from politicians and the facts that exist out in the real world.
In another article, you reported that if the estate tax was repealed in the way that it's been proposed by President Bush, the very rich could legally reduce their income tax bills. What did you report about that?
Well, there are a lot of different ways you could repeal the estate tax. The president's proposal would eliminate all reporting at death, and it would also repeal something called the gift tax. You have to have a gift tax in order to keep the integrity of the estate tax. And we broke a story in January that the way in which the president designed his plan would allow very wealthy people to avoid significant income taxes by legally making gifts to relatives and getting the money back tax-free when these older relatives died. Say you have a stock that you bought for a dollar that's now worth $100 million. If you want to sell it, you'd owe $20 million in capital gains taxes. So you give it to Aunt Martha, who's in her 80s. Aunt Martha dies, that comes back to you. Under the president's plan, you'd now have your $100 million and you would owe no income taxes on that money. We also showed how people would be able to avoid state-level income taxes on their investment income and how you could cut your spouse out of all of your money and leave your spouse penniless under the president's plan. Say you don't like your wife and you have a girlfriend, you could give all her money to you with no reporting or knowledge, and she could end up with the money, undermining state laws designed to protect spouses in the ownership of marital property. At the time, the story was very heavily criticized by people who said that's just wrong, and they said that because they had not read the actual legislation. Subsequently, Congress had its tax experts examine this issue, and they concluded that under the president's plan, over the next 10 years, wealthy Americans could use these techniques to avoid $185 billion of income taxes. As a result of our story, the finding by Congress, the president then altered his plan and removed all of these provisions that would have allowed these legal games to be played by the very wealthy to avoid income taxes by manipulating estate taxes.
The president would like to repeal the estate tax, but there's also a movement to just reform the estate tax, to change it. What are some of the proposals to change the estate tax instead of repealing it?
The estate tax is a tax on your right to transfer wealth and property to someone else. Congress has long provided for exemptions, and currently the exemption is such that 98% of Americans aren't subject to the estate tax. Only the top 2% are. But the exemptions have not kept pace with inflation. The $600,000 threshold set in 1986 should today be about $1 million, but the threshold now is only $675,000. In addition, there's been a fundamental change in the way people hold their retirement assets. It used to be most people got a pension and didn't own the asset. Now people own their retirement accounts and live off the income from those, and the estate tax has not been adjusted to deal with that. So there are a lot of people who propose that we should raise the threshold on the estate tax to $1 million immediately, perhaps to as high as $5 million for a couple, in order to keep this tax relatively narrowly focused on people with very substantial wealth, a lot of which has never been taxed during their lifetime.
Any predictions on what the likely outcome of the estate tax debate is going to be?
Well, Terry, tax systems have to follow the economic order. And because of the way the world economy is changing, I don't expect that we will see outright repeal of the estate tax. It used to be that in an agrarian world, the king or whoever the ruler was took part of your crops, and that's how the state financed itself. Once we went to an industrial wage-based economy, we and most of the rest of the industrial world quickly went to an income tax system. Well, we're moving from a national industrial wage-based economy to a global digital asset-based economy. And the tax system is going to need to recognize that assets are a fundamental aspect of the economic future, and the tax system is going to somehow have to address that. So I'll be surprised if we have outright repeal of the estate tax.
If the president's tax cuts go through, or if most of them go through, how much less money would we be collecting in taxes, approximately?
Well, over the next 10 years, tax revenues would go down by about $1.35 billion. At least that's the best estimate. But going forward from there, when the tax cuts are fully phased in, because most of them are delayed to the end of the 10 years ahead of us, revenues would drop very sharply. So the question isn't really can Washington adjust its spending to deal with the next 10 years. We can certainly choose to do that, and we just choose to buy different services or fewer services for ourselves through our government. But going forward from 2011, where the tax cuts really take full effect, the revenue loss to the government would be significant, and it would require some fundamental rethinking about how the federal government operates if we're going to have a balanced budget going forward.
What kind of fundamental rethinking?
Well, Washington now, since World War II, has been run on the notion that we want the federal government to be a major supplier of services in this country. Now, there are four basic areas where the government spends most of its money. The military, interest on the national debt, Medicare, and Social Security. And that's about 80% of federal spending. If you want to restrict the spending going forward, you restrict income to the government, and then we're going to have to look at how we're going to finance the government long run. Clearly, the advocates of less revenue to the government have taken to heart the statement of the great conservative philosopher Edmund Burke, who said, "The revenue of the state is the state." If you want the state to be smaller, the most effective way to do that is to restrict the revenue to the state. So by passing the tax cut today, we're making budget decisions that are going to continue for a long time into the future. Now, it may be that we'll enter an era here of enormous economic progress and the government will grow enormously in its revenues, and there'll undoubtedly be pressure for a new tax cut. It may be that we will end up in a situation where we will either have to go back to borrowing money rather than taxing for it in order to maintain spending, or we will have to reduce our spending.
Some of the rationale behind the tax cut is that there's been, budget surpluses. And part of that budget surplus comes from the fact that the stock market has done so well. A lot of people have made a lot of money in the stock market and paid more in taxes. In recent years. What happens if the stock market goes into decline and stays that way for an extended period? How does that affect the logic behind the tax cut?
Well, most of the revenue, first of all, comes from the income tax on wages and salaries. That's more than 80% of federal income tax revenues comes from that side of the equation. However, the fundamental question is, I think, a very sound one. Long-term budget projections just aren't accurate. 10 years ago, the projection was that today we were going to be in a terrible, terrible situation. We were going to be borrowing hundreds of billions of dollars a year, and interest on the national debt was going to continue to swell and become the biggest item in the federal government's budget. Then we raised taxes on high-income people in the early 90s. There were a lot of predictions that this would lead to economic disaster. In fact, that's not how it worked out. And the linkage between how heavily we tax people and at the top and how much revenue the government takes in is pretty tenuous. So I think to make projections more than 5 years out is pretty tenuous. And in all likelihood, we will go through an economic cycle over the next 10 years. No one's repealed the fundamental laws of economics, and we're going to see the government have periods when revenues go down and periods when revenues go up.
David K. Johnston covers the tax system for the New York Times. Last month, he won a Pulitzer Prize for his reporting on tax inequities and loopholes. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. As Congress continues with its complex process on the budget and tax plans, we're talking to New York Times reporter David K. Johnston. He won a Pulitzer Prize last month for his coverage of tax inequities and loopholes. Let's talk about a loophole that you reported on. In March of 2000, this is one of the articles that won you the Pulitzer, you reported that on a loophole that could cost the Treasury as much as $4 billion a year. What was this loophole?
Companies that sell property and casualty insurance, that's the kind of insurance you have on your house in case it burns down or gets burglarized, have discovered that if they move their parent corporation to Bermuda, just open a little office there with a few file cabinets, they can avoid paying taxes on their investment income. And it turns out that's the only place property and casualty insurers make money. You send in your check for the insurance on your house or the business that you run. The company then goes out and invests that money. They're taxed on that investment income every year. And over the next 20 years or so, they will pay out in claims 100% of what you paid to them in premiums. Well, if you move your operation to Bermuda, instead of paying a 35% federal income tax on every dollar of profit you make investing, you can pay zero tax. Now, you do have to pay a 1% excise tax when you send the premium out of the country, but that's a much smaller tax than the income tax. A number of large insurance companies who don't want to do this because they would face enormous tax burdens because they've been in business, say, 200 years and have huge built-up capital gains that would be taxed. Because if you want to leave the U.S., if you're a company and set up offshore, you've got to pay your tax accounts up to date as you leave, have objected to this. And we found out they were lobbying in Washington to stop other companies from doing this. There's a fundamental trend, though, by American companies to do this. And indeed, if I were setting up the next General Electric right now, I would not domicile it or headquarter it in the United States. I would set it up in Bermuda, and then I'd put all my operating units in the United States. I'd make all my profits in the United States, but I would arrange to transfer those profits to Bermuda, and I would operate in the U.S. without sharing any of the obligations of citizenship.
Is it just Bermuda?
Well, Bermuda is the place of choice to do this. There's a group of industrial nations who have been fighting what they call these tax havens, arguing that they are encouraging behavior that's harmful overall to industrial economies. Interestingly, the Heritage Foundation has taken up the cause of these small islands and argued that this tax competition is a good thing, and that places like Bermuda are actually good for the United States because they encourage the U.S. to keep taxes low on business.
So when was this loophole written into the tax code, and who put it there?
Well, like most loopholes in the tax code, it wasn't expressly written into the law. It comes out of how one deals with the principles that exist in tax law. Because we live in a global economy, not a national industrial economy, but a global economy, it's our policy to encourage trade. And as a result, our policy is that we tax individual Americans on their worldwide income. You move somewhere else in the world, you still have to pay U.S. income taxes. But we tax corporations on their domestic income here in the United States. So just as we've seen a lot of news stories in the last 10 years about companies moving manufacturing jobs overseas and investment overseas for tax reasons and keeping those investments overseas, now we're seeing a movement to move corporate headquarters overseas for the same fundamental reason, that you move to a jurisdiction that is lightly taxed or not taxed at all, but you conduct your profit-making operations in the U.S.
So what was the impact of your article on this loophole?
Well, the first thing it did was it brought a lot of attention to this issue. It has resulted in a bill that was introduced last year and was reintroduced this week in Congress, designed to minimize this activity and to make it unattractive for companies to set up their operations in Bermuda. That's come under attack from people who argue that it violates fundamental principles about free trade. Underlying that, Terry, is a more basic issue that we're not debating in this country, and that is, since we now live in a global economy, do we want to continue to tax corporations at all? And if we do, do we want to continue to tax them the way that we are? Because it's creating enormous inequities. Certain companies that have to operate in the United States or by size operate in the United States face relatively higher burdens than those who are able, for a variety of technical reasons, to move their corporate headquarters overseas.
My guest is David K. Johnston. He's a reporter for The New York Times. Last month, he won a Pulitzer Prize for beat reporting for his coverage of inequities and loopholes in the U.S. tax code. Do you think that sometimes people are for a tax break, assuming that they're going to get a big tax break and it'll help them financially, and that they sometimes don't understand who's really getting the benefits of the tax break, and it's not necessarily them?
Oh, Terry, there's lots of evidence that shows that. And let me give you one of the best examples of that. Less than 2% of Americans pay estate taxes when they die. But surveys show that 17% of Americans believe that they have to pay estate taxes. And while I don't believe in taxicab journalism, I made it a point over a couple of weeks to ask every cabbie in New York City who picked me up what he thought about the estate tax. And I was absolutely astonished that 7 of the 8 cabbies told me that when you die, the American government, all these guys were immigrants, the American government takes half of what you have. And I said, well, are you married? Yeah. Have you got $1.35 million? Of course not. Well, the government doesn't take anything unless you have that much money. No. I heard it on the radio. And they would cite a couple of the most widely listened to commercial commentators who were saying, you know, we've got to stop the estate tax. It takes more than half of your money. And they had no context to understand that until you've got $3 million on the margin, the government doesn't take half. And if you do any kind of reasonable planning, you've got to have about $20 million of wealth, which puts you in an extraordinarily narrow bracket of Americans, before the government would take, at your death, half of your estate.
You said that you'd like your articles to help the American public talk about the real issues and not just the rhetoric. Let's look at what is often called the marriage penalty. What is it, and is it really just a penalty for married people?
Well, there's a marriage penalty and there's a much less discussed marriage bonus. Because we have a progressive income tax, the more you make, the more you pay. Then when you have a two-income couple who both have similar high incomes, they pay more in taxes than if they live together as two single people. On the other hand, if you have one spouse who makes a lot more money than the other one, the second spouse is not at all a primary wage earner, you actually can end up with a marriage bonus. You pay less in taxes because you're married. Now, there are a variety of ways to fix this, and the legislation currently in Washington does not fix it. One way to fix it, since almost all tax returns that are complex now are done on computers, is to simply allow people to calculate their taxes as if they are married filing jointly, and to have the computer recalculate it if they were single, divvying up deductions any way they want between them, and you would then have a neutral system. There have been other proposals that are somewhat technical by various experts in the field on how to make this issue of the marriage penalty and the marriage bonus go away. But remember, if you want to remove the marriage penalty in an even-handed way, then you're going to take away the bonus for some people. unless you let them be taxed as single individuals. Most industrial countries, by the way, tax married couples separately. They tax you individually on your own income. But the marriage penalty can be very severe. If you are a married couple and each make about $100,000, I think currently the marriage penalty is around $7,000. So one could argue that in order to have a license to sleep in the same bed, the government's charging you a fee of about $20 a day.
So because there, for some people there's a marriage bonus, whereas for others there's a marriage penalty, do you think that the rhetoric has unfairly colored the debate? The rhetoric, well, which just talks about the marriage penalty and not the marriage bonus.
Well, I think that what the rhetoric's done is not allow people to understand that the proposals in Washington won't eliminate the marriage penalty. You'll notice if you listen very carefully that the politicians who last year were talking about eliminating the marriage penalty are now talking about reducing it. And what they're proposing to do is say, we'll not count $3,000 of income of the lower earning member in the couple in order to reduce the penalty. Well, that'll help a lot of people in the $40,000, $50,000 range, but people in the case who each earn, say, $100,000, it doesn't help them hardly at all. And that's not real reform. That's the appearance of reform. It's not going in and fundamentally fixing the law by making it simpler, making it easier to comply, and treating taxpayers fairly based on their circumstances. Whether you make, as a couple, $40,000 or $100,000, why should the couple who makes $40,000 and they both work be freed of the marriage penalty, but you continue to impose it on a couple who each earn $100,000?
My guest is New York Times reporter David K. Johnston. He won a Pulitzer Prize last month for his reporting on tax inequities and loopholes. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is David K. Johnston, and he won a Pulitzer Prize this year for beat reporting for coverage of the inequities and loopholes in the U.S. tax code. He writes for the New York Times. The staff of the IRS has been greatly cut back over the past few years, and you've reported that the IRS is going after fewer people who have not paid their taxes. It's auditing fewer people, and the Treasury is losing a lot of money that way. Is the government saving enough money because of the cutback on employees enough to compensate for the amount of money that it's losing in taxes?
Oh, no, it's not even close. The IRS operates on a budget of right now about $8 billion, and it's going to bring in $2 trillion this year. So that the administrative overhead cost to the government of collecting taxes overall is less than 1%. MasterCard charges more than that to the merchant when you charge something at the shopping mall. The Internal Revenue Service is an agency that has focused on the wrong issues for a long time. I've reported extensively on how we've reduced audits of high-income people. But what the government's done in doing that is reduced audits of people who control their income. You and I work for a wage, Terry. We get a paycheck. The government gets a report from our employer. Here's how much Terry Gross got paid last year. And they check it against your tax return. But if you own your own business, you're in control of what you say is your income. Government's virtually stopped auditing those businesses. If you get money from a trust, from a partnership, if you get what's called a K-1 form, the government has made virtually no effort to go after those people and to focus on them. In addition, and I think this is the best evidence of how totally weak and ineffectual the IRS has become, last November on the front page of the New York Times, I named 23 businesses who have publicly declared that they do not withhold taxes from their workers' paychecks, and they have stopped filing returns with the federal government. It's now more than 5 months later, almost 6 months later. All the IRS has done is written letters to these businesses saying, excuse me, sir, you're supposed to pay your income taxes.
And these are businesses that withheld their paying their taxes because they don't believe they should pay it. They're anti-tax people. This is their protest.
They believe the tax system is a hoax, that we've all been tricked, and that the way they read the law, or I should say they deliberately misread the law, they contend that the law doesn't make you liable for income taxes. And every one of the arguments that they've made have been reviewed by the courts, and I've gone and examined them myself, and not one of them holds up. They're malarkey. But the IRS hasn't done anything to these people. So if you're one of the competitors of these guys, look at the position you're in. You're withholding taxes from your workers' paychecks. You're paying taxes, payroll taxes, the other side of Social Security, on behalf of your workers. And your competition down the street's getting a free ride, and the government isn't doing anything. I mean, can you imagine if we had written the same story on the front page of the New York Times and said, here's the names of 23 drug dealers in the city of New York, and here's the street corners they work at. Do you think 6 months later the cops would have done nothing? I don't think the sun would have set before the cops would have acted.
So you see this as a sign of how ineffectual the IRS is now?
Absolutely. The Internal Revenue Service has been stripped of resources. The number of tax returns has grown by about 28%, while the staff of the IRS has fallen by 15%. The IRS has all these cumbersome new rules that Congress enacted in 1998 under the IRS Reform and Restructuring Act just to collect a tax debt that there's no dispute that it's owed. They have to now go through 33 new steps in order to enforce collection of that tax. It used to be they could use something called a jeopardy assessment against people like drug dealers and others who they had reason to believe the money would disappear. Now they have to, and they could do it almost instantly. So they could seize money from criminals. Now they have to give them 35 days notice. Well, I assure you, you give 35 days notice to your local drug dealer, you're going to seize his $1 million in cash you didn't pay taxes on that you'll never get a penny.
Right.
And in fact, one of the laws passed by Congress in recent years, the 1997 Tax Reform Act, has been described, we've quoted people in the New York Times as calling it the Drug Dealers and Mobsters Tax Relief Act of 1997.
So what was the logic behind passing it?
Well, this claim that jackbooted thugs from the IRS were out harassing poor, innocent taxpayers. Congress held hearings on this in 1997 and 1998. We showed in the New York Times, as did other publications who investigated these witnesses, that a lot of these witnesses were not to be believed, that some of them were, although not prosecuted, probably should have been as major tax criminals, that fundamentally the most explosive testimony they made didn't hold up. And Congress's own investigative arm, the General Accounting Office, concluded after it investigated this matter, and by the way, its initial report was suppressed by the leadership in Congress, but it did later come out. They concluded that while there were anecdotal examples of some individual IRS agents who had behaved improperly, there was zero evidence, no evidence whatsoever, of any systematic abuse of taxpayers by the Internal Revenue Service.
So do you think that cutbacks in staff, the severe cutbacks in staff at the IRS, is a result of the movement in America that both hates taxes and hates the federal government for collecting them?
Oh, I think it's a clear movement of that, and I think both parties are party to this. Taxes have been put into an area that's been so demonized that no one wants to touch them, and there are only a handful of people in Washington who will get up and say, as Bob Dole did about 10 years ago when he slammed his fist on the table, that we need to go after the people who are not paying, that we need to enforce the law. In the entire United States, there are only 2,700 tax cops. That is, the people who are essentially detectives at the IRS who investigate criminal tax abuse, they can each do maybe two cases a year. Last year, in the whole United States, we prosecuted about 700 people on the principal criminal charge of tax evasion. That's ludicrous. In the city of New York alone, we have 45,000 police officers. We are not treating tax crimes as a serious matter in this country, and we're not going after people like the businessmen who we named in the Times, of whom there are many more now, by the way. More and more people have been openly declaring that they're not paying taxes and saying, gee, appeared on the front page of the New York Times, the IRS didn't do anything. What better proof that the tax laws are a hoax? And at the same time, other people who know the tax system is legitimate continue to operate without being noticed at all by the federal government because there's no effort to hunt for those people. The focus at the IRS is on people who chisel. You know, did you take too much on this deduction? Did you short the government $114 over here? Not on people who make $1 billion, as one couple did in New York City, and don't even file a tax return.
Well, people not only, on the whole, don't like to pay taxes, they don't like to read about taxes. Taxes are very complicated things to read about. No one understands the tax codes. Did you want the tax beat in the New York Times, or was that something you were assigned and reluctantly took on? And I'll remind our listeners that you just won a Pulitzer Prize for your coverage of tax loopholes and the tax code, tax inequities.
And Terry, when I came to the New York Times in 1995, I absolutely wanted to cover the IRS and tax policy, and I proposed it to the New York Times. I think it's one of the really important issues that has not been well covered. And in my whole career, I've always tried to go cover things I didn't think were getting proper attention. Every one of us has to pay taxes. Nobody likes paying taxes, including me. And taxes have always been covered in terms of either the blather of politicians, da-da-da-da-da-da, comma, Senator so-and-so said yesterday, or advice on how to nickel and dime your way to a smaller tax bill. There have never been consistent beat coverage on an investigative and enterprise level about how the tax system works. Over the years, there were some great investigative pieces about the tax system, particularly in the Philadelphia Inquirer, where I worked for 7 years. And the editor of that paper, when they were doing their tax coverage, became the managing editor of the New York Times, brought me into the New York Times, and wanted also to do this subject. There certainly were editors at the Times when I came who thought, you can't do this, it's boring. And looking back at my clips, some of my stories in 1995 and 96 were pretty boring when I was basically going to my own individual tax school and making readers suffer through my papers. But there came a point when the principles became very clear. And then once you understand the principles of tax and you have good sources in the tax world, which is full of people who very much want fairness and equity and transparency, then you can take it out of the high priest language and you can talk in the vernacular about the tax system. And that's what I've been trying to do. I've been trying to bring sound insights to an issue that's mostly covered with sound bites.
Well, I want to congratulate you on the Pulitzer Prize, and thank you very much for talking with us about taxes.
Thank you.
David K. Johnston covers the tax system for the New York Times. Last month, he won a Pulitzer Prize for his coverage of tax inequities and loopholes. This is Fresh Air.